Hello, and welcome to Between Two Term Sheets, Canada's only podcast that invites investors and founders to discuss the early-stage funding environment in the high-technology space. Our host is Owen Matthews, founder, CEO, serial investor, and general partner at Wesley Clover International.
So welcome to Between Two Term Sheets. We're here today having a conversation with Ben, who is based down in the Bay Area. And Ben, why don't you just take a minute to introduce yourself and you know where you come from and what makes you qualified to be talking about investing today.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I think, you know, qualification is that I like to talk, and so if people choose to listen, then that's all good. I'll tell you where that discussion comes from, the things that I've drawn to sort of whatever I have to share. I was an entrepreneur for 25 years. I took a company public in the bubble, a company called FashionMall.com, that I started in 93 and took public in 99. That was in New York City. The world changed pretty aggressively. I had never raised venture. I still owned the majority of that company, so I was able to take it private. It was a good outcome for all the investors, not just myself. And I moved west. And about 12 years ago, I noticed this big gap between angel and venture, which is currently called seed. You know, back a dozen or so years ago, angel investing was a very, as it is a little bit today, very disparate group of people, either acting individually but more likely in groups, putting in relatively small checks, usually being pretty passive. And venture had gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And there was this gap in the middle where smart people with a great idea needing $500,000 to $1 million back then didn't have a ready source to go to. One was too small, one was too big. So for about a decade, I was what I would term an institutional seed investor. I differentiate seed investors from angels in that angels can be hobbyists or part-timers or just like to put some bets into things in that angelic form and see how it works out. While the combination of institutional and seed, institutional is someone that does this for a living. It's their only focus. It's what they want to make their career out of. And seed is that you're taking an approach to it that is similar to the way a venture capitalist would take their approach to Series A. You know, you're actually going to do some diligence. You're going to want to believe in the long-term nature of the company. You're going to want to be willing to give aid along the way. You're going to do deals that are reasonable in their form. Do it sort of the right way. And so full-time versus part-time might be a way to put it, but I think that sort of oversimplifies it. And then lastly, in terms of what that yielded, 10 years, 80 companies, more than half of them raised Series A and beyond from Tier 1 firms, many of which came from my introductions because I have a very broad network across the venture industry. One IPO, about $2.5 billion of the private exits. Ended up spending 2 years as general partner at a venture firm before ending up here at what I want to be my lifelong journey here forward, which is as a partner here at NEA. I'm a venture partner right now at what I consider to be the single best venture firm in the world. And this is having gotten to know 320-ish VCs at the top 15 firms over the last 10 years. So those are the stories from which all my random wanderings of communication come from.
That's wonderful, and I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. You're one of the few people I've spoken to on the program that is similar in background to what we do. You know, we've been professional seed investors for a long, long time, passionate about the companies, and it can be very rewarding and for us anyway. We're in it because we're passionate about it. Getting involved in the very, very beginning and seeing them grow into great companies is a great pleasure of mine, and it's nice to have you so succinctly put. You know, I sometimes get categorized as an angel, and I might bristle a little bit about that. And I appreciate you you so succinctly differentiating it for me. So anyway, thanks for coming on board today. So as a specialist in seed, there is definitely important criteria around the seed investment that really sets you up for a typical venture investment of A round or more. Give us some guidance around, you know, what should the entrepreneur be looking for in that seed round? What are the characteristics of the seed investor that really is a stepping stone to that later stage investment?
I've got really strong views here. And, you know, remember that packaging this, I spent 8 years exclusively as a seed investor. Then I went and spent 2 years as a traditional VC where my focus was almost entirely Series A, B, and C. And now I'm at a place where I have the luxury of being able to do the entire range, seed at A and B and all the way up, because NEA is the largest venture firm in the world at the moment. The things that I always thought about for myself as an investor that I also thought were important for my entrepreneurs were whether or not we were pulling together a syndicate of people that could add value, not just capital. You know, if you're an entrepreneur and you're going out there to raise money, there's a time when you're doing that when you just need the money. And if all you can get is the money from one source, then it's highly likely that's the source you're going to take the money from. But if you have the luxury of choice, this is the time that you need to really exercise as much diligence as you can in learning about that investor. Because, you know, it's part of this stems from when I had a public company, there was a board of four. One of us, me, one of us I trusted, and two people that fundamentally wanted to run the company that caused some friction. You know, I wouldn't say we had the best of relationships at all times. And I remember that quite well, because when I think about being an investor of value to my entrepreneurs, I want to be that one guy that was trusted by the founder. And I also want to help that entrepreneur find others that will be value add, because I know how hard it is and how debilitating it is to have somebody that is either challenging to you in a way that's not healthy, and there's plenty of ways to be challenging in healthy ways, or that can even be debilitating. And so a lot of, if you go all the way down the stack to quote-unquote angels, a lot of them aren't going to show up or do anything anyway. They never say they're going to, they're not going to bother with that, and there's no harm, no foul, that's not what they're in this for. But somewhere between some of the angels and some of the seed, or a lot of the seed, people talk about all the value they can add. Of the ones that say they're going to add value, a small subset will. So at any level, I think it behooves the entrepreneur to find out from the entrepreneurs, the person they're considering has done business with, to see what sort of value they brought to the table, particularly in hard times. You know, everybody's great when times are good. It's when times are tough that you need to find out how people are going to operate. Because, you know, these are long journeys. You know, it's 7 to 10 years to get from funding a company probably at the A, not even at the seed. For the seed, it's probably more like 8 to 12 to get to the kind of magnitude that people desire for venture scale returns. If you've got a goal of building a public company, that's not a 3-year journey, which means you're in that journey with the people that you've brought in, particularly the ones that make it onto your board, for a long, long time. And you better understand how they're going to operate in smooth sailing and rough. Because if you don't, you end up getting surprised at the worst possible time. And that's a painful reality to face.
Yeah, that's, you know, advice that, you know, we have seen over the years. There's no doubt that the challenges that you face when you don't expect it, you know, when you think about, you know, specific elements of that, you look at the terms that people often will say are not a challenge. And yet when the time comes, they turn into big challenges. So, you know, yes, absolutely terms, but it really comes down to the character, you know, who's fighting for those
terms. Yeah, because those terms, it's funny, people obsess about terms in their term sheet a lot. I was having lunch with a lawyer who'd like to do more business with myself and with the firm, and we were talking about sort of how I think about the world. I think that lawyers do their job best when they reinforce the agreement between business people, not when they try to improve it. And we're talking about some of the random terms that people care about. Like, you know, every once in a while an entrepreneur will say to me, well, my counsel's really telling me I shouldn't let these people have, reg rights. And it's like, you've got to be kidding me. There's 12 years before that's going to matter. They have every right to have their stock registered. It's a plain vanilla terms. It sounds like they're boosting up their bill. But here's the real reality. Yes, you want your docs to have correct and appropriate terms. NVCA terms are a good standard, or Series C terms are a good standard to use. But when push comes to shove, the terms are meaningless, because it depends on the relationship and the trust you have. Because a person that is there to make sure things go as well as they possibly can for the company and for you, and I'm doing that in that order specifically, because everybody has a fiduciary duty, and the company ultimately is the primary responsibility, but the founder is really close behind it. You know, they can work around in a positive way things to affect an outcome that is required or desired. You know, they can't break their, no one's, you know, I'm not talking about people that will break their terms to disadvantage an entrepreneur. I'm talking about the opposite. I'm talking about somebody that, even though by the terms of the deal it should be X, they're willing to go ahead and make it Y just so that the outcome becomes better for all involved. And that comes down to a relationship, not what's written on a piece of paper. I think that the relationship is so much more important. And, you know, entrepreneurs, with the guidance of their counsel, will spend an enormous time working through the terms of the document, as they should, but they'll spend a tiny fraction of that time getting to know the partner that's going to be across the table and figuring out how they're going to play. If they had a choice, I'd switch those two. Trust the lawyers to do their job. Don't fight back on a lot of stuff because it's usually meaningless. And spend your energy figuring out how it's going to work with this person when you need it to work in a different way than was documented.
Yeah, I can summarize that as, you know, we go, well, you know, we'll try and fit within market, and if that's kind of market terms, that's great. You know, let's carry on. But it's about the people, and it's about, you know, their character and their history and their ability to help you execute. And that often gets missed. You don't want to compare two term sheets, you know, down to the letter. It's really about who's behind them.
And a lot of times the outcomes I've seen are driven far more by the people around the entrepreneur supporting them than by anything to do with the terms. You know, sometimes terms, particularly out-of-market terms, are predictive about behavior that you want to be on the lookout for. It's funny, I don't know if I feel the same way, but one of the things the lawyer I was spending time with, really senior guy at one of the firms, said to me is, you know, I pretty much can predict the quality of a deal and how it will go based on how hard the documents are to draft, you know, how difficult the negotiating process is. He sort of has this view that the hard-to-do deals, from the standpoint of all the battling between two parties, is usually a predictor of future challenges. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was interesting. I have to think about that a little bit. I've only had one deal that was sort of challenging in terms of getting it done, two sides having different views, and that deal did not work out, but a data point of one is not adequate. But it's interesting. I do feel like there was a deal long ago that I was an investor in as a seed investor, and I was new to the business. I was only like 1 or 2 years in, and one of the other investors from, who was an LA investor, had put in a participating preferred, and the investor from the Bay Area said, oh, I don't like to see that so early. I just don't think that's fair. It's a problem, and it's going to cause problems in the future. And I was like, I don't know, whatever. You know, I didn't have a clue. I didn't even know what it meant. I had to look it up. Well, what I learned over time was, yeah, it was a totally out-of-market term to have in a seed deal. That party was a very aggressive party, and they caused all kinds of hardship for the rounds thereafter. In fact, I'm pretty sure I was crammed down in a pay-to-play in an up round led by that inside party. So I have another data point of, yeah, I get it. When people are being that aggressive about protecting their best interests early on, I'm not sure I'm excited. Because just to sum that, this community, and it's probably the same for you, although maybe not for everybody in your community, but this community is obsessive about not losing out on the upside case. There's not nearly as much focus on downside. I can lose all my money. I just want to make sure I get to participate on the upside. And I think once you leave Silicon Valley, at least in the U.S., you know, L.A. and New York, a lot more downside protection, a lot more, I don't know, unique structure to make sure everybody gets their money and more back out. And I don't think that necessarily aligns them with the entrepreneur in the way that I'd like to see them aligned.
Yeah, it's banking behavior. You know, how do I foreclose on my mortgage if you can't pay? You know, it's not what we're in this for. And for me, it's the visceral experience of helping the companies and rolling up our sleeves and creating the opportunities that lead to great companies. And that's the behavior that drives the successes that keep this industry fueled. And I think that's often missed.
Yeah, I think that if people truly grok how big it can be when it goes well, truly understood that to their core, and knew that things never followed a straight line, that the vicissitudes of entrepreneurship are quite severe, you know, perhaps they'd think less about protecting from the downward dips and think more about even a smaller percentage chance of the truly enormous upsides. I just don't ever want to be in a position, I used to say this when I was a seed investor all the time, you know, I'm willing to lose all my money. I don't want it to happen, but if it's what happens, it's part of the game. When you go out and try, if you spend half my money and it doesn't work, don't come back to me and give me back the other half. Go figure out something else and try again. Now, two corollaries to that. One is, if you spend all the money and it doesn't work, don't ask me for more. I gave you the shot. I'm not doing a second seed. You took your shot and it didn't work. We're, you know, no harm, no foul. Let's find you a home. But you know, the other part of it is I don't mind not being able to protect myself from a zero, but I absolutely mind if I can't protect myself from the one to X. If there's something that keeps me from participating on the upside in any event, that I have a challenge with. I'll take absolute binary risk, but I will not limit the upside that I can have by being in business with you. That's not a fair trade-off.
That's a, I think that's a view I agree with. That's great, and that's why we're in this business, and that's why we're not punching for 2 or 3% returns in a secured loan or something like that. You know, we're not bank bonders. Let's talk about the current climate. What's it like? Competition for deals. What's the interest in Valley investors looking outside the Valley? You know, what are you seeing these days?
I'd say overall, fewer deals getting done, but for a lot more money, which you can translate into fewer deals that people get excited about. But when they get excited, lots of people get excited, and there's fierce competition to win. So you end up with both more capital going in and probably higher valuations because of it, because it may be more capital due to a competitive reality, not necessarily more capital because the business needs it. But the one offset to that, and I'm talking about Series A, B, C, but to a lesser extent also in seed, because it's also true that there are less seed deals being done for a lot more money. You know, 10 plus years ago when I started, seed deals ranged from $500,000 to $1 million. And if you wanted more than $1 million, I would back you down as much as I could to the extent I had the ability to do that and say, whoa, 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 you know, you're getting really pushy there. That's sending a pretty aggressive message. Well, today, seed rounds go off at $2 and $3 million routinely, and some go off for a lot more than that. So when you raise more in the beginning, it gives you more runway, it gives you more proof points. Seed rounds aren't designed to build businesses. They're designed to prove a thesis. Once you prove that thesis, you then discover whether or not you've proven enough to raise that next round of capital to truly build the business. And so when you have more money to prove those theses, sometimes those theses are bigger or more developed, and so you then need even more money to go forward to the true company building that lies ahead. So in addition to that, seed over the last decade has empowered far more people to compete in the game. I used to use the analogy that in the old days, Series A was like the Olympics, and now it's like CrossFit. You know, in the Olympics, every country sent its best competitors that had already won some races and done quite well. That was sort of the top person out of Google or Cisco or wherever.
Yeah.
Today, if you can do push-ups faster than the next guy, you could qualify to go to the games. That's the CrossFit model. So you can get there to the competitive field, but you've got to win to get to the next level. And that has created a much larger playing field with a lot more people on it, and that has also risen the bar for what one has to achieve. In the days when a four-minute mile had never happened, the four-minute mile mattered. But after the four-minute mile mattered, it didn't matter anymore. And so it's how much do you beat that four-minute mile by? If you're running four-minute miles in a four-minute mile world, you're just keeping up with everybody else. People need to see 358, 357, 350. And that has made for a far more competitive landscape, because literally everybody that breaks a land speed record on foot sets the bar for the next person. And it's irrelevant whether they're in your industry or not, because, you know, a partner at a tier one firm is going to do one or two Series A, B, C deals a year. And if that's the case, and you've got four companies you're looking at, and three of them are 358 runners, and one's a 342, you know the time is going to go into the 342, regardless of category. And it's an almost impossible feat for someone to do two or three deals at once. Two deals at once, wow, that's hard. Three deals at once, I'm not sure I've ever seen a human being achieve that, because the amount of time put in, just as the entrepreneur needs to get to know you, you need to get to know them. There's diligence to be done. These are very much all hands on deck, drop everything, work on it now, get it done. And, you know, that reality has made for a different climate and landscape. So fewer deals, more money, and probably more fiercely competitive when the deals happen.
That's great. It's good to know that this capital is still there for the great companies, but there's a lot more analytics and detail and proof points, a lot more objective measures, I think, in looking at companies these days. You know, it used to be you'd have a discussion about, you know, the potential, and there was a lot of sort of subjective details. Now with clarity around digital customer acquisition and I mean, you can quantify the success in a way that you couldn't before, and that at least in our view, is having a pretty big impact in what drives the excitement around a deal.
Yeah, I think that sort of going to my analogy of we know what a push-up looks like. How many can you do in a minute? Now, there are still deals that get done on, let's call it overall form, but those are rare. Those are usually the superstar that has a track record going back to the Olympic model. But I think, yes, there's a lot more that's quantifiable. You've had more time and more money to get to that point. And there are, you know, it varies by category. You know, insurance tech has been something that's been very hot for quite a while now, and people put in a lot of money before proof. I think that's probably sort of being modulated a bit now, and it's probably toning down, and people wait and see who the winners are. But, you know, a lot of early money and a lot of big numbers and big quantity. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And there's always a category or two where that's the case. You know, AI, something that, as an example, you know, various parts of Canada are doing
lots of money,
AI.
Lots of money going into it, and still uncertainty around how you really measure the positive outcomes.
And whether they end up being a product or a consultancy or a company. And remains to be seen. The winners will be huge. That's what always drives venture. When someone sees a new category opening up that they either hadn't thought of or that hadn't been attacked, and maybe it's just a little early, but that's okay, because the right player is going to just have this enormous market that they take over with huge winners. And generally, more than one group gets funded to try to attack that. It's sort of like you're funding, I don't know, seven sailing ships to go find America and hope that you're funding the one that actually gets there, lands and makes a beachhead that can be protected. Mm-hmm. You know, doesn't always work, but the people always want to try because that land's worth a lot.
All right. Now, what any advice on, you know, companies from the outside the valley, you know, getting credibility or finding ways to attract investment? I know it's never easy being an outsider when you come into a tight-knit community, but there are a lot of investors in the valley. Any advice around that?
Sure, there's general and specific. The first, most general of all, is nothing succeeds like success. Right? If you want to get credibility, deliver. You know, you deliver enough. Like in a $1 million ARR world, deliver two. In a $2 million ARR world, deliver three. Those sort of things break through a lot of clutter where people will say, hey, I'm not sure, but you know what? These guys are outperforming the entire sector. Let's take a look at what they're doing and why and see if this is something we should pay attention to. Two, on a slightly more granular level, but not all the way to the micro, you know, warm intros are always better. So I always tell my entrepreneurs and my friends, milk my LinkedIn profile. If you're one of my entrepreneurs, like if I know the people, I'll make that introduction if the appropriate. I used to also have another rule, by the way. When I was doing seed, I always said, I will introduce you for your Series A to the best people in the world if I believe you're ready for your A, not if you believe you're ready. Mm-hmm. We both have to have the same view. And it was pretty rare that I would say no, but it did happen because I protect my relationships. My rank order is family, founders, fund. And founders and fund are arguably tied, but they're pretty damn close. Now, having said that, when I was a seed investor, I think of it as being the adoptive parent to 80 children. I mean this metaphorically. These are not children. These are super smart, bright people. Think of it like Professor Xavier's School for Gifted. These are the literally most gifted people on the planet. If I'm going to take my sub-functioning, non-performing son into my friend that is metaphorically the head of admissions at Stanford and say, you should really give this kid a chance, then my rock star daughter is not going to get that opportunity the next time because I will have salted the earth. So I've always been very protective, and I think people are in general very protective of their relationships. Having said that, asking for the double opt-in, which is what anybody should be doing anyway, which is getting a paragraph from you in a deck and forwarding it on and saying, hey, this looks interesting to me for the following reasons, with some credentialing of how well you know the person, would you want to take a look and give them the chance to say yes or no, is a pretty common methodology. The third level, totally micro down to me, is I realize that it's really hard for people, and I don't want people to be missing out because they don't have a pathway into me. So I create a site called PitchBen, which is www.pitchben.com, where anybody anywhere in the world can film a 1-minute video pitch, and I will, time allowing, and sometimes it takes a day and sometimes it takes 2 weeks, give them back a 1-minute video response with my sort of instantaneous sort of feeling about what they're pitching. And that could range from, here's the challenges I see, to, that wasn't a pitch, that was just a random blather, which I think has only happened once, where someone just wandered all around. I was like, this isn't a pitch, man. You don't even have, you know, you don't know what you're pitching.
What do you do again?
To, this is interesting. Well, that that one, the nice thing is I promised them the time. I don't promise them anything thereafter. But yeah. I have asked multiple people to now follow up directly by email. I give them my private email and say, send me a deck. Once again, the sort of time delay there is not insignificant. But using pitchbend.com has been an interesting way for me to let anybody pitch me and get, at a minimum, my visceral reaction to their pitch. I obviously cannot understand everything about their business in a minute, but what I can tell them is what my gut tells me about what they're pursuing. And to the extent that can be valuable for calibration, I want it to add value. And I want it to be a way that I can get exposed to more things. So, you know, I haven't seen anybody else do that yet, but maybe...
I haven't seen that, and I like it. I think it's clever. All right. Well, anything else you wanted to add? I mean, I really appreciate your time. It was very informative and very, you know, very clear and concise, as you always are. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I think the fact that you do this is great. I mean, I think every opportunity for entrepreneurs to hear from people that are willing to be candid and talk about the experience and how to optimize it is always going to be useful. I give presentations to entrepreneurs all the time, and, you know, eventually one of them will say, you know, I just wish there was a podcast like this. So it's good that there are. They just aren't mine. I just get to do that. So, I don't know. Tell them all to come visit pitchben.com and throw me an idea, and we'll see. Maybe this will yield the next big thing.
All right. Perfect. Thanks so much, Ben.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
So that's it for today's show. You've been listening to Between Two Term Sheets. This episode is brought to you by Alacrity Global, which brings investors, academic institutions, entrepreneurs, and governments together to create technology startup funds around the globe. Go to alacrityglobal.com to find out more about Alacrity's initiative. And be sure to tune in again to next week's show.